Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Greetings and welcome. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up on today's broadcast, around the corner when Pope Benedict XVI goes to Santa Sabina for Ash Wednesday celebrations, the Procurator General of the Dominicans, Father Robert Ombres, will be among those to welcome him. Shine the spotlight on Santa Sabina, discovering a church where Saint Dominic once prayed. We offer you a seasonal reflection by the title of People of Dust by Jesuit Father Gerald O'Collins. And finally, we take a look at the Roman Emperor Claudius. Would he remind us of Napoleon, Kennedy, or Churchill? Our Latin lover replies.
Well, thanks very much for joining me once again. In Rome, you're not likely to miss Carnival, or Carnevale, as the weeks leading up to Shrove Tuesday are called here. It's visible in your local bakery, with the special pastries you eat exclusively at this time of year, the delicious frappe and castagnole. It's visible on the pavements, where children in colourful fancy dress costumes have strewn streamers and paper confetti. In the streets, as teenagers have their customary shaving cream fights outside schools. And looking around later on in the day, in the grown-ups, perhaps not so tasteful wigs. But if it's true that all here in Italy enjoy the carnival fun, it's also true they know that Lent is round the corner. Most know too, that's if they've read their newspapers or listened to the evening news, that Pope Benedict XVI issued his 2007 Lenten message on Tuesday this past week. In it, the Pope departed from the customary social focus of papal Lenten messages in order to emphasise that Christian charity must have religious motivation. The message, a meditation on the crucified Christ, as the fullest sign of God's love, called on Christians to contemplate Christ's suffering and then work to alleviate situations in which human life and dignity are threatened by poverty, oppression, exploitation, and abandonment. Another thing many people know here, especially if, like myself, one happens to work in the Vatican, is that the Pope begins Lent each year by going to the Church of Santa Sabina on the Aventine Hill for Ash Wednesday celebrations. I have to say it's a very special place where St. Dominic himself once lived, and where today his followers, the Dominicans, known as the Order of Preachers, have their generalate. And it's precisely there that my colleague, Alberto Boroni, went earlier in the week to speak to the Procurator General of the Dominicans, Father Robert Ombres.
All Catholics, and we know many people, take an interest in the Pope's reflections, which are both clear and deep. But we here at Santa Sabina, we Dominican friars, feel particularly close to the Pope in Lent because, by tradition, the popes begin the season of Lent by coming to Santa Sabina for the distribution of the ashes on Ash Wednesday. And this makes every Lent particularly memorable for us at Santa Sabina. In his reflection offered to all Catholics, to everyone on Lent, Pope Benedict chooses to emphasize, to echo really, what he said in his first encyclical about the nature of love. And he suggests that by looking at the pierced Christ on the cross, we'll understand the nature of God's love for us and of us for God and for one another better. I would say this about Lent. The traditional practices of Catholics for Lent are fervent prayer, fasting, and giving alms to the poor. And it strikes me that these three traditional practices are three ways of seeing how much and how we love God, that's in prayer, how much and how We love our neighbour, especially the most needy, as the Pope underlines in his Lenten message, by giving alms, and how much we love ourselves, and how, and that's through fasting. So what might seem old-fashioned, no longer applicable practices take on a new relevance when seen as three ways of asking ourselves with seriousness and with joy how we stand with God, prayer, how we stand with our neighbour, especially those most in need, giving alms, and how we stand in regards of ourselves by fasting. May you have a fruitful Lent and a glorious Easter.
Thanks there to the Procurator General of the Dominicans, Father Robert Ombra, speaking there at the microphone of Alberto Goroni. Meanwhile, I'd like to take you on a very personal guided tour of this church where Pope Benedict goes on Wednesday with Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis. A tour that deserves a hushed voice. Let's step back then to the 5th century, which is the date this church goes back to.
In fact, it's probably the most intact Paleo-Christian church in Rome. Inasmuch as others have been added to, things have been changed, or maybe they've been burnt down, restructured inside. Here, no.
It's almost bare, isn't it, apart from the columns and the walls. I mean, we're so used to the Baroque churches in Rome that this is kind of like a shock.
Yes, in fact, but it also points to the essential simplicity and the sense of the sacred of the early Christians, who didn't look for pomp and circumstance, but at the same time aimed at creating a building which was as grandiose as possible to give honour to God and to express in a temporal sense something beyond the temporal. So you can see the space in a Paleo-Christian basilica has to do with movement. You have to walk around. In those days, there were no seats in churches, so everything has to do with the optical effect. The moment you enter the main door, you look up and your eye and all energy that you have in your body and in your spirit moves completely. You're literally pulled forward towards the altar. And this is helped by the fact that on each side you have these magnificent Corinthian columns, almost perfect, which came from a temple in this area. And they managed to be able to match them all so well. It's incredible the way they did this. You get the feeling of the sense of building upwards. Now you notice here there's no transept in the sense that we know it. It's not a Latin cross church. Here you have the pillars going right smack up to the apse. So you get this feeling that you're pulled right into the altar. And then you have this explosion of colour. You have every window in the place just bouncing colour off everything inside, like polished stone on the floor, pieces of inlaid marble, the mosaics that remain and those that would have been here in the past.
The element of light is an important one in early architecture in particular. If you read any guidebook, they'll write about this church and say there's a golden light.
And we're here in the morning. Imagine at midday when this golden light is at its maximum. And the selenite windows tend to push in a strong way, like rays of light into the church, but at the same time tempering these rays of light, not to the point where it becomes so stark that you get dazzled. No, when the light comes in, it moves all around the church, bouncing off the mosaics, bouncing off the floor. But the whole idea is that you go forward enveloped in this light, so it's like a luminous pathway going right up the church towards the apse, towards God.
Breda, you say that we are projected towards the altar, yet a few metres before you get to the altar, there's an enclosed space, a sort of marble wall, as it were, with a little gate. Why is that?
Well, this is the area of the shola, as people call it, or scola. It's the area which enclosed whoever was celebrating or praying. And this, obviously, to maintain the sacrality of the sacrifice that's going on at the altar. The Eucharist has to be, obviously, kept in its dignified space with all the ritual related to it. And in this area, priests, bishops, etc., would sit and pray and sing. I think of St. Dominic. He used to prostrate himself here. He had 9 ways of praying which relate to the body for himself and everybody else in the world, outside the brethren, obviously. Think about the quantity of prayer said in there.
My thanks there go to Professor of Fine Arts Breda Innes for taking us on a tour I suggest anyone who visits Rome should go on. Perhaps not on Ash Wednesday, though, when Pope Benedict goes. Ash Wednesday, when celebrations leave us people of dust with a visible sign on our forehead. Stay tuned as well-known author and theologian Jesuit Father Gerald O'Collins offers us a reflection on this celebration.
Years ago, I met a man who told me that he knew only one thing about Christians. It was something 2 of his friends at work did once a year. They both go off together at lunch hour, he told me, and when they come back, they have a little ash on their foreheads. What his friends did once a year was to go into a church on Ash Wednesday and receive the ashes. Well, in a few days it will be Ash Wednesday once again, and around the world millions of Catholics and some other Christians will be doing the same thing. A priest will sprinkle a little ash on their foreheads and say the words, "Remember, you are dust, and unto dust you will return." Ash on our foreheads shows us what we are, people of dust and destined to die. Dust stands for death and for things breaking up. Dust is not like the beautiful rocks we can dig up in the mountains or the lovely seashells we find along the shore. One speck of dust is just like another. It doesn't belong anywhere. It's barely visible and noticeable. In a way, we're all like that, mortal human beings heading towards death. Our lives can even seem pointless and meaningless, like dust about to be blown away. An Arab friend once said to me, "Our lives begin as a drop of seed sown in desire and end as a handful of dust." Thinking that way about the start of life is perhaps a good reminder of how fragile we really are. Why am I here at all? My mother and father need never have met. Circumstances should so easily have been different and never brought them together. 6 years into their marriage, without going into the biological details, another human being could have emerged to take a place in the world. But that new person would not have been me. I need never have existed. We're all Ash Wednesday people. We exist between a drop of seed sown in desire and our end, when we will become a handful of dust. Probably this is the last thing any of us want to be told on a fine Sunday evening. I can just hear my sister-in-law saying, "Jerry, would you please be cheerful and say something positive?" Now, I'm all for being positive. God is extremely cheerful and very positive too. But God is also realistic. We too must be realistic and come to terms with what we are. Death is as important as birth. But we're not just little piles of dust to be blown away finally on the wind. We are much, much more than that, because God loves each one of us and loves us with an infinite and faithful love.
You were listening there to well-known author and theologian Jesuit Father Gerald O'Collins. Heartfelt thanks to him. And now moving on in a big way, it's time to leave our Lenten focus behind us and on a lighter note, join our popular Latin lover. He's Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, who today offers us a portrait of one of his favourite Roman emperors. A word of warning. Watch a change of tone. Claudius. Who was Claudius? What was his name to start with? Tiberius Claudius, Caesar Augustus?
No, Caesar, Tiberius Claudius, Caesar, Augustus, well...
Why does he have so many names?
Well, it depends on where they came from, you see. And because, Claudius, how does it work? Tiberius and thing there. And then he's the son of, so he's Tiberius's nephew. You see, Tiberius and Germanicus were brothers.
So it's all connected to their family names.
Yes, yes, yes.
But I read that he did a bit of name dropping in the sense that he dropped some of his names and he got rid of Nero and adopted Caesar.
Okay, okay.
Why did he do that?
Well, I mean, you know, because, well, I don't know what. Because Nero, I mean, it sounded bad, of course, is black in Latin. And that was before Nero's time, obviously. And Nero was a little baby in Claudius's time. But that was his, Tiberius, Claudius Nero. That was his father's name.
And of course, because he invaded Britain, he was granted the honorific title of Britannicus.
Britannicus, which he didn't use, but he gave to his son, you see. I mean, he had a title to his to Britannicus. And then he had a little boy by the name of Britannicus, who was killed. He was suffocated by Nero.
How do you say suffocated?
Yeah, strangulatus or suffocatus est. A terrible story in Tacitus, the death of Britannicus at a dinner. They kind of poisoned him or something like that. And he had like a fit or an epileptic seizure or something. It was terrible. But you see, Claudius passed his name to his son, little Britannicus. Because they entered England there. Mm-hmm. And he was going to get this great title of taking over England. Well, they didn't.
Why did they invade England? Because of its material wealth. There were mines and slaves there, no?
Mines and slaves, yes. And they were interested in what was happening on that end of the world. And it was the next thing because the Romans had taken over, what do you say, Gaul, France today, Belgium, the Netherlands. The Romans had taken over the thing. The next thing was, which Caesar did twice, you know, he went across the English Channel to Britain twice, in 55 and 54 B.C.
And Claudius?
Over about 2 or 3 weeks. And then Claudius went over kind of with the idea of taking over the thing well, anyway.
So you mentioned Gaul. He was the first Roman emperor to be born outside of Italy, in Gaul, in fact.
Yeah.
In Lyon he was born, no?
Yeah.
It was part of the Roman Empire.
Yeah, certainly. It was like the capital of Gaul in those days. Yeah, exactly.
Do you think he would have liked the French national anthem they have today, the Marseillaise?
He would not have liked that. Well, they didn't understand.
How would you translate the Marseillaise?
I don't know what. Carmen Gallicum or something like that.
Was he interested in art? He was an eclectic character, no? Claudius. Do you think he would have liked the Impressionist painters better or the great Picasso in his Cubist heyday?
I don't think he
would
have understood that stuff too much.
How do you translate Impressionist painters?
Oh, my Lord.
And Picasso in his Cubist heyday.
Oh, my Lord, no. Pictores Impressionum. That would be Impressionist. At Picasso... Picasso's, I don't care what his name is. What do you say?
In his Cubist heyday.
Okay. Maximo in suo cuborum culmine. On the apex of the cubes. Everything sounds better in Latin. Believe me.
You know, I'm a bit curious. Can you identify for me some of his more famous contemporaries? I know that his tutor was the great Livy, no?
One of them. Of course, he was much younger than Livy. But anyway.
Well, if he was the tutor, he should have been younger, no?
Yeah, I know. And Livy was the historian, and Asinius Pollio. Mm. And if you ever saw I, Claudius' movie, there's a beautiful scene, I'll never forget it, where Livy is the historian, and Asinius Pollio, another historian, old man, are sitting on a bench, and they see this young guy with a manuscript on the table. That's Claudius, you know, and he got a book from the library or whatever it was. And they ask Claudius, what do you think about our histories? Oh, it's beautiful. I can almost cry now. And he said, I appreciate Livius's style, but I appreciate more Pollio's history. and here you have one of the three most famous men in the world sitting there in the movie. It's very beautiful in the garden.
How do you say movie?
In cinematografeo.
Cinema.
Cinematografeo.
We have more correct English than you people.
Or it's ludis cinematographicus. We have to do something there.
Okay, well, you didn't tell me who some of his more famous contemporaries were.
41 to 54, exactly 13 years. Well, Seneca was around there. The Plinys were around there. Quintilian was teaching Latin in those days. And the most famous men in the world were there, really. Tacitus was around there.
Talking about famous men, if you had to pair him off with a statesman, who might it be? Napoleon, Kennedy, or Churchill?
My, oh my. I would say Churchill.
Why?
I don't know why. Because of the balanced intelligence. He was an intelligent man, but he was very extremely balanced and very kind of moderate. From a distance, as I see things.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is a bit flippant. How do you say flippant in Latin?
Flippant. Levis et nugatorius.
Okay. Levis et nugatorius. If he'd had to choose to meet with Gandhi or Mao Tse-tung, who would he have chosen to converse with?
Gandhi, for sure.
Because of the peace thing?
Yeah. Mao might have been a little... He wouldn't have under, like, extreme, a little too extreme. Maybe, I don't know.
Well, yes, but he, I remember that Claudius, when he issued a coin, no? To emphasize his clemency after the assassination of Caligula, he had on it the depiction of the goddess Pax Nemesis, so maybe he had a thing about peace.
Yeah, certainly.
So he was more of a peacemaker than a rabble-rouser?
Oh, for sure.
How do you say peacemaker and rabble-rouser?
Peacemaker is pacificus and rabble-rouser is vulgiturbator.
Are you more of a rabble-rouser or a peacemaker?
I refuse to comment. And I can understand that. Because he was an intelligent man. I really love Claudius. And he wanted to end all this civil strife. About every 20 years there was another civil war. And after Caligula, you see, and after Claudius came Nero, and they had another one, everyone was fighting everyone, and he just wanted peace.
He was a judge, too, no?
Well, okay, let's say in the sense that the emperor, you know, would sit there and listen to the cases and decide on the spot. In that sense, he was a judge.
He settled disputes in his colonies. Little bit of translation there. He'd say that he was easily swayed when he
Facile me move batur.
When he settled disputes in his colonies.
Cum lites suis in colonias dissolveret. That you can say easily. In fact, he used to go there and say, by the way, I'm coming, and the cases in court I shall preside over. And he would sit there and bing, bang, boom, bum. Then he would go away and other judges would take over.
Claudius was a writer himself. He was a budding historian. How do you say that? A budding historian?
A nascens, well, exoriens historicus. Well, he did. He wrote a whole history of the Etruscan people. Gentis tuscae historiam conscriptit. Well, that was his thing in the library. That's why they thought he was crazy. And he wrote a grammar about the Etruscan language. All of this has been lost. And then another thing he wrote, and that's where you get Robert Graves from. He wrote his own autobiography, which has been lost. So Graves comes along and says, maybe we can kind of reconstruct what he would have written about his own life.
A puzzle.
And that's where he gets,
you know... A puzzle to be put together. How do you say that in Latin?
Okay. Enigma componendum. Mm-mm. Well, see, that's what Robert Graves did, because we know from history that Claudius wrote the history of his own life like his autobiography, which has been lost. So they tried with Graves and company and Robert and Grant later on, you see, tried to reconstruct what Claudius's autobiography would have looked like. That's how we get the whole books and the movie and everything else. Because of the mention of this autobiography, which we don't have.
He also wrote great edicts. Edicts.
Edicta?
On everything from medical advice. One of them promoted yew juice for a snake bite. How'd you say that?
Yew juice. What is yew juice?
Well, let's say tree juice.
Bene, bene. sucum arboris ad anguis morsum, with a snake bite. But also, I never heard of that myself.
Well, I read that somewhere. But he also wrote one on the status of sick slaves.
Oh, yeah.
So he was a bit of a socialite in the sense that he not in the sense of a
and jet, of course,
what not is in the sense of a jet setter. How do you say jet setter?
A jet setter. Okay, I don't know what a jet setter. How are you going to say initial velocissimus cursor?
In the sense that he was interested in social issues.
Oh, absolutely. And you probably don't, I don't know whether they had this on your little biography there. He was the first one and caused a big uproar. He appointed many of his freed slaves as his ministers of government, which caused no end of controversy. You know, what they call libertus, a freed slave. He would make Secretary of State and Secretary of Treasury. And these people were very competent, and he knew this. He's an intelligent man. And he started this whole thing of parting out the departments of the government to his freed slaves, which a lot of people didn't like, but it was very intelligent. Because, of course, they were dependent on him. He could trust them, and they were very competent. No, Claudius is a good man.
I read that he cracked lame jokes, which is a horrible thing to say because he was a bit lame himself. No?
Yeah, he had some things I can
but
remember.
This is like a lame joke, no?
Yeah, I mean, in the Senate, he would say some things that he thought were funny, which were not funny at all.
But did he have a sense
like
of humor?
Like he says, I think one of my slaves says that he has hair snow in spring, which is half brown and half white, and such stuff. And he thought this was very funny.
You said
that were lame jokes. We have about four or five lame jokes where he thought he was saying something clever, and people were just looking that this idiot thought this was funny.
Okay, one last thing about Claudius, then we'll come back to him some other day. You said he wouldn't have liked the French national anthem, the Marseillaise. Would he have liked any opera?
He'd probably be a little bored with the length of it.
What would he have liked?
I mean, maybe like some a little dance and music. That was all right.
Like what?
I don't know what. I mean, a little concert.
A polka.
A polka or a little Mozart or a Haydn concert. All right. 12 minutes. The whole opera he would have... He probably would have gotten very impatient.
Maybe he would have liked Figaro, if he cracked that lame joke on people's hair.
Okay, well, Figaro, okay, with the barber, okay.
Warm thanks, as always, to our popular Latin lover. He's Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, the Pope's own Latinist. He'll be back again at this same time next week. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Be sure to check out our website. The address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now.
Laudator Jesus Christus.